suddenly I'm having to think about, do I need to fill up just in case? That's never occurred to me. Is my energy supply going to go bust? Because apparently they're the next one on the list, so I keep genuinely checking most days whether my energy supply still exists. It does, as of yesterday. We take these things for granted. We did. And yet now, it feels like chaos. And so we feel powerless. The world looks so permanent, we feel so powerless. And so, we take those things and we think, well, if that's how I feel now, we project that up onto God and go, well, maybe he can't keep the promises he's made. Think about what it must have been like for Israel in Babylon. So Israel have been taken to a land that isn't their own. They are under the power of the biggest empire of their day. That empire would have looked pretty permanent and would have made Israel feel pretty powerless. A small nation overpowering the biggest empire of its day? Unlikely. They couldn't have seen a way out by their own strength and power. They would have felt stuck. And when God makes promises, like, I'm going to bring you back out of exile, it would have been a perfectly reasonable, at one level, question for Israel to say, really? Really? Because Babylon looked pretty strong right now, and we feel pretty weak. God seems willing, but can he? Can he really do what he says he's going to do? There was a survey done a few years ago, interviewing Christians from loads of different groups, and asked them three questions. Do you believe God is all-powerful? Do you believe God is all-loving? And do you believe God is all-knowing? Now, however you slice up the data, whether you slice it up by race or by gender or by age or by denomination, in every single way you slice up the data, God being all-powerful was the one that was believed by fewest. All-loving, yes, we can believe that. Of course we believe in a loving God. And frankly, a large chunk of our society who hardly even really believe in God still believe in a loving God. All-knowing, yeah, we can hold to that one. That kind of makes sense. God can know all things. We don't understand quite why he does things the way he does, but he can know they're going to happen. All-powerful. That God really is in control of absolutely everything. That's the one that's most doubted. You can see why, can't you? Because the world around us doesn't really feel like there's an all-loving, all-knowing God in control of it. It feels chaotic. It feels confusing. But here's why I think we think like that. This is a quote by a theologian who lived about 100 years ago. He said this: one cannot speak of God simply by speaking of man in a loud voice. One cannot speak of God simply by speaking of man in a loud voice. That is, the worst way to think about God is to basically think, well, I know what a human's like, so I'm just going to make him bigger. I know what I'm like, so I'm just going to make him bigger and stronger, and if I keep doing that enough and enough and enough, I'm going to end up with God. If that's how you think about God, it's not right. And we all do it. The theologian's point is that we can't do that. We will never end up at the God of the Bible if our starting point is us or other humans. And yet so many of the times that I question God is because I start with me and assume God's just a bigger version of me. So why would God allow this to happen? Because if I had his power, I wouldn't. You see what word comes up quite a lot in that sentence? I. If I had his power, I wouldn't do it this way. Implication, God can't really have the power he says he does, or he can't really care about my suffering. Why are churches growing so slowly or shrinking across our land? If I was in God's shoes, I wouldn't do that. I'd see the church grow. Why do I still struggle with the same sin that I've been struggling with for years? If I was in the Holy Spirit's shoes, I'd have dealt with that a long time ago. Do you see the logic? The minute I start with me and project myself onto God, I question him. I doubt him. One cannot speak of God simply by speaking of man in a loud voice. And that is why Isaiah 40, verses 12 to 26 exist. Because of that way that all of us think. Time after time after time, we all think like that. And that is why Isaiah 40 exists, to shake us out of that thinking and to comfort us in our doubting, to shake us out of thinking of God as just a bigger version of me, and to comfort us when we doubt that he can do what he says. We're going to see two big things. First, we're going to glimpse the all-powerful, all-knowing creator. The all-powerful, all-knowing creator. Look down at Isaiah 40 with me. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? How much water do you reckon the hollow of your hand can hold? Probably not a cup's worth. I was going to try it this week and I never quite got round to it. Not very much is the answer. Who has measured all the waters of the earth in the hollow of his hand? Or it goes on. Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket? What do you hold in a basket? About 30 items of dirty clothes. God holds the dust of the earth in his. Who's weighed the mountains on the scales? I could probably just about fit a molehill on my scales at home. God weighs all the mountains of the earth. If that's not enough, verse 26, lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all of these? Estimates vary on how many stars there are in the universe, unsurprisingly, because it's not that anyone's got the time to count them. One estimate I read this week is there's a septillion stars in the universe, which is really helpful because we know what that is. We don't. A septillion is a one followed by 24 zeros, which is a lot of zeros. That didn't help me either, so I tried to work out a way that I could just about work out what that is. And so here goes. I'm just trying to imagine this. So imagine the whole Earth is covered with grass, including all the bits that's currently ocean. Imagine going around and cutting every single blade of grass and counting every blade of grass as you go. Do that 10,000 times, and that is the number of that number of blades of grass, that is the number of stars in the universe. That is a bonkers number. That is how many stars they reckon there are. God created all of these. He brought them forth, and he knows them by name. Back in Isaiah's day, the way that they could see just how incredible a creator God was is by looking outwards. And we can still do that today. We also, due to the wonders of modern science, can look inwards. If you take your DNA, just the DNA in your body, in all your cells, and you line it up in a line rather than in its twisted thing in all of your different cells, that line ends up being twice the diameter of the solar system. That is just in your individual body. God created that. God came up with that concept. That is how big the God of the Bible is. Who is like the Lord? Who can you compare him to? We all struggle to have a view of God this big, don't we? We all struggle to picture and imagine a God who is genuinely this powerful and genuinely this awesome. And yet that is the God the Bible reveals to us. He is the all-powerful creator. And he's not just the all-powerful creator, he's the all-knowing creator as well. Every single human's experience of knowledge is basically the same, which is that you're born basically ignorant, and every single moment of your life is coming to know something. You're constantly learning something new, either because you've heard it for the first time or it's happened for the first time. And most of the time, you're coming to learn it from other people. You're constantly learning. God has never learnt anything. He has never learnt anything. Verse 13. Who can fathom the Spirit of the Lord or instruct the Lord as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? Or who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? No one. God didn't create by committee. God didn't get someone to check his measurements before he flung the stars into space. God didn't run his grand plan for the universe past a management consultant to check he got it right. He doesn't need to check with anyone because he never comes to know anything. He knows it all already. He's not just one step ahead of us. From before the foundation of the world, everything that would ever happen, that does ever happen, God knew it already. And that means God is never surprised and never disappointed. He is never surprised. He's never disappointed. Never disappointed by our lack of obedience, because he always knew it was going to happen. Never surprised by a global pandemic, because he knew it was going to happen. God was not surprised that you put your right sock on first this morning, or left, depending which way around you did it. He wasn't surprised by that. Before the foundation of the world, he knew every big thing that was going to happen and every intricately tiny thing as well. And he knew all of it at the same time. That is the God that Isaiah 40 reveals to us. There is never a time where God has learnt anything. God is not just a bigger version of us. He's not just different from us in degree. He's not just a bigger version. He's completely different from us in kind. This God is not one whom you can come to know by just speaking of man in a loud voice. You can't just take your understanding of a human, make it bigger, and get to God. God is completely different from that. He knows everything. He is powerful over everything. We need to recapture this view of God in our lives, don't we? I mean, maybe you've all nailed it, but I haven't. Here's how one pastor explained a way to help you recapture this. He said, why not for a week, every time you wash your hands, cup some water in your hands. And just think that God does that with the oceans. Why not this week when you do some baking and measure out the ingredients? Why not remember that God weighs out all the dust of the earth? Why not this week, next time you ask for advice or come to learn something, which will happen quite a lot, just ponder, God has never had that experience. He never once has had that experience of fresh knowledge. That is the God of the Bible, the all-powerful, all-knowing Creator. And Isaiah 40 calls us to come and behold him, to cast our eyes to just how big he is. Because he is the one who's going to help us overcome those doubts. If you want reassurance as to whether his promises come true, he says, look at him. As we're going to pause and we're going to sing, Behold Our God. It's the obvious song, it's the easy song. It's a song that the writer was almost definitely writing with Isaiah 40 open in front of him. Let's come, let's behold this God together, and then we'll think about the second half of our passage. Let's stand and sing. And then in comparison, Isaiah shows us the all-powerless, all-nothing creation. The all-powerless, all-nothing creation. You see, there's only two types of thing in the world. Fundamentally, there are only two groups of thing in the world. Group one over here is the Creator. And in that category is God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. He is that category. Everything else sits in category two over here, creation. Only two categories. And in this category sits us, sits the universe, sits the animals, sits angels, sits Satan. There's only two categories in our world, the creator and the creation. And there is a big black line between the two. There is no overlap. This is no Venn diagram. There is nothing that blurs the boundaries. The all-powerful, all-knowing creator and the all-powerless, all-nothing creation. That slide is intentionally different font sizes, by the way, before you think that that's, I thought that was funny when I did that on Friday. You can decide whether you think so or not. There are only two categories, creator and creation. And the way Isaiah shows us that is he lines up a few different things to compare God with. Verses 15 to 17, he lines up the nations, and they are as a drop in a bucket compared to him. When you finally get around to mopping the floors 6 months after you were supposed to do it, you look in the bucket and there's like one drop of water that somehow has survived from last time. That is the nations when compared to God. They are as a drop in a bucket. They're regarded as dust on the scales. If any of you have ever tried to get to a target weight because you've been trying to lose weight or trying to beef up, I guess either way, you've never thought, well, just to check whether my weight is really right, what I need to do first is I need to clean the scales because there's going to be dust on it and that's going to throw the reading out of whack. You don't do that because dust on the scales is nothing. That's what the nations are like to God. Nations the size of Russia. Nations the population of China. Nations with the military might of America are as nothing compared to God. The nations as nothing. Next thing that Isaiah lines up, idols, verses 19 and 20. Let me read those. As for an idol, a metal worker casts it. A goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. A person too small to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot. They look for a skilled worker to set up an idol that will not topple. See, in Israel's day, they had big physical idols. And basically the way you could compare nations was how impressive their idols looked. So my statue's bigger than yours. My statue's got more gold on than yours. God exposes the foolishness of that, doesn't he? See, in God's economy, he made us. And we are to worship him. In the way Israel and the nations around it thought about it, they make an idol and then they worship it. The order completely flips on its head. No longer the creator being worshipped by the creature, instead the creature worshipping its own creation. How foolish. They get the wood, they make an idol, and then they worship something that they have made, that by definition is less powerful than them, because they have control over it. That is so powerless that they have to be very careful to stop it toppling over. That's what they worshipped. Now, we're too sophisticated to do that, aren't we? But don't we set up things that we make, that we then live our lives by? Our man-made career ambitions. Our man-made targets for financial security. Our man-made relationship goals. We set them up. And then we let them control us, forgetting that we've created them in the first place. The idols do not compare to God. There is nothing compared to him. The nations, the idols, and then thirdly, the rulers. Verses 23 and 24. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of the world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground, then he blows on them and they wither. Like a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. I can list off the great rulers of our world, past, present, Napoleon, Alexander the Great, Nelson Mandela, take your pick, and they're gone. That's what God says compared to him. He blows on them and like wind carries chaff off into the distance, so God blows the leaders of the world away. That would have been really, really hard for Israel to understand, wouldn't it? So put yourself back in Israel's shoes. They're under the thumb of the Babylonian Empire, this empire that seems so strong and so powerful. They cannot possibly imagine that God can just blow Babylon away. Question. If you asked everyone in the world today, where was Babylon? What percentage do you reckon actually know the answer to that question? Not very high. What about if you ask them, Name a single Babylonian king. How many of them do the answer to that question? Probably even fewer. And probably the ones that do know the answer are people like us, and we know them because they're side stories in God's story. That's why Babylonian kings are still known today, basically, apart from amongst a select group of historians, is because they're people that God walloped and defeated and humbled and destroyed. Israel, we're told, God brings the rulers of the world to naught. We've seen that for the rulers that they faced. We've seen that for other rulers since. That will happen for other rulers again. Every empire rises and every empire falls, because none of them can stand compared to the Lord. Nothing stands in comparison to him. It's not to say that none of these things actually have any power. It's not to say that nations are genuinely powerless or rulers genuinely can't do anything. It's just to say that when you line them up against God, they are completely nothing. They are as nothing. First, a word that Isaiah repeats again and again. They are nothingness. They are naught. They are worthless. They are less than worthless. They're powerless, temporary, fleeting. The minute God decides their time is up, they're gone. That's it. The all-powerless, all-nothing creation. And yet in our day-to-day life, those things seem so comparable, don't they? Because they keep their promises in a tangible way, whereas God's promises seem so intangible so much of the time. And so every now and then, there are passages in the Bible that just kind of draw the curtain back and show us what's really going on. And this is one of those, showing us that as much as it feels that those things have real power over us, and it feels therefore that they must have real power over God, they don't. They are as nothing. God is truly incomparable. To whom will you compare him? With whom then will you compare me, says the Holy One? Here's how one author puts it. Nothing in creation can be compared to God without making God seem far smaller than he actually is. Nothing in creation can be compared to God without it making God seem far smaller than he is. It's by a guy called Andrew Wilson in a book called Incomparable. The minute you compare something to God, you make God seem smaller than he actually is. Have you ever thought about why it is that there are so many different metaphors for God in the Bible? Why is it that God is referred to as a shepherd, as a father, as a husband, as a king, as a potter, as a warrior, as a vineyard keeper, as a protective hen, and on and on and on we could go? Why don't we just have one metaphor for him? It's because one would do him a complete injustice. You put one metaphor of what God is like, and it will tell you basically nothing really about what it's like. You'll end up with such a deformed view of God. Instead, the Bible gives us absolutely loads of them. Because as we piece all of those together, we start to just get just a little glimpse of what the God of the Bible is actually like. He's a bit like a shepherd, he's a bit like a father, he's a bit like a king, he's a bit like a warrior, he's a bit like a vineyard keeper, he's a bit like a protective hen, he's a bit like a potter, and on we can go. And as we piece those together, we start to get a little picture of what the God of the Bible is like. See, nothing in creation can be compared to God without it making God seem far smaller than he actually is. Do we ever doubt that God really can keep his promises? I do. The world feels so permanent. The world makes us feel so powerless. We need reassurance that God really can keep his promises. And when we need that reassurance, what God says to us is, look at me. Just look at me. Just look at who I am and what I'm like. And that will give you the reassurance you need. I want to introduce you to someone. She's called Harriet. She became a Christian in her teenage years, and she did that thing that a lot of people do when they become a Christian as a teenager. They just get so excited about finding Jesus for the first time. They are just so thrilled to know him. They overflow with joy. They abound with zeal. And so Harriet went and told everyone she could about Jesus. She loved living for him. She loved coming to every prayer meeting, every church meeting, every weekend away. She was there. She loved spending time with other Christians, and she loved telling people about Jesus. But then as the years rolled on, Harriet got a bit worn down, a bit more worn down, and a bit more worn down again. So you see, she got discouraged at the lack of seeing God at work. She was discouraged at the lack of seeing God at work in her own life. That sin that she thought she'd have beaten years ago still persisted. She was discouraged at the lack of God's apparent work in her life. She was discouraged at the lack of God's apparent work in her friends, as every single one of her rejected this message that she received with such joy. She was discouraged by the lack of God at work apparently in her church, which just over time, numbers slowly dwindled. Never any kind of big pop moment where it all went wrong, but just the numbers started shrinking, and it just kept going one way. There was no uptick. She was discouraged, she was worn down, and she was tempted to give up. She started to really doubt, can God really do what he said? He made those promises that I received with such joy 20, 25, 30, 40 years ago. And yet I don't see fruit. I don't see change. And so can I really trust him? All the friends I've made along the way who've died and gone to be with Jesus, do I know they're really there? I can't know that for sure, can I? We want to think they are. Maybe they're not. Maybe it's all a nonsense. How can I trust that God will really keep his promises? How can I trust that it's true? Maybe it's all just empty hope, a nice fantasy to cling on to. That's how Harriet felt. I wonder whether you can sympathize with any of Harriet's story. Don't know where you are on the graph of her life. Well, what Harriet needed was to lift her eyes to this God. What she needed was someone to come alongside her and say, behold your God, who has made all the stars in the heavens, who has measured all the waters of the earth in the hollow of his hand. To whom can you compare him? Because the answer is abundantly clearly no one and nothing. No one compares to this God. And so when we doubt that he can keep his promises, we can know with absolute confidence nothing can get in his way. Nothing can stop him because nothing compares to him. In order to be able to stop someone, you have to be comparably strong or comparably wise or comparably big, whatever it is. There is nothing that is comparably anything to God. And so nothing can stop him. Harriet needed to know that. I need to know that. It's a fair assumption that all of us at times need to know that. The all-powerful, all-knowing Creator will keep his promises. He will keep his promises to Harriet, and he will keep his promises to us. Let me pray. Father in heaven, thank you that you, our God, are incomparable, that no one compares to you. Father, when we doubt that you can keep your promises, help us to capture that bigger vision of you. Help us to see that you are the one to whom no one compares and no one can stop. And so, Father, please, would you help us to trust your promises and to live in the light of them, even when they seem so far-fetched and so hard to believe in our day-to-day life. Amen.